The last year has been really a spiral for human rights in Turkey. It's the purge that has happened on the back of that attempted coup, of anyone who is remotely critical of Erdogan and his policies and his government is astounding. And Amnesty's documented this really, the most recent, which is only in the last month, if you've started seeing there was an arrest warrant put out for 100 IT contractors. But we've seen it across all sectors and industries in the last year. Thousands of people have lost their jobs. Hundreds and thousands of arrest warrants have gone out. Each month there's a new roundup, basically. Tons and tons of people have been detained. Anyone who's a critical voice, anyone who's well known, anyone who stands up for human rights, democracy, free speech, has become on the bullseye, in a sense, of Erdogan.
Welcome to Upvote, a tech and politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. I'm Roland Matthorpe, Associate Editor of Wired.
And I'm Kelly Fiveash, News Editor of Ars Technica.
Today, we're doing something a little bit different. We've left the cupboard where we normally record, the cupboard that last time around, Matthew Taylor described as sordid.
He did.
Yes. If you'd like to listen to the rest of that interview, that's available online now. But we have come to Islington, to the UK headquarters of Amnesty International, because today we're going to talk about technology and human rights, especially in Turkey, where, as you may know, there is a very aggressive, quite scary and new crackdown going on against dissent in all forms, but especially online. To do that, we're joined by Tanya O'Carroll, Advisor on Technology and Human Rights at Amnesty. Tanya, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And there's a personal connection to all this with Amnesty, because very recently, the head of Amnesty in Turkey was arrested by the Turkish government. What was she doing when she was arrested?
So, yeah, she was attending a routine workshop, sort of workshops that we run all the time at Amnesty, working with human rights activists in civil society in Turkey and training them on things like how to stay secure online, but also not just the kind of online aspects, but all of the emotional and well-being aspects, because Turkey's been going through this awful crackdown in the last year since the attempted coup, and it's increasingly become a very, very difficult place to carry on doing human rights work. Speaking out, being a journalist, being an activist is, pretty risky work. And so they were attending a workshop that was supposed to be kind of supporting their resilience as activists, well-being, as well as how do you kind of stay safe online. And suddenly they were stormed, the workshop was stormed, it was broken up, there was 10 people there, two of them were international trainers, and they were all arrested, and they've now been in jail coming up to a month, close to a month.
And they've been accused of orchestrating an uprising.
Yeah.
So we've got a bit more detail about this workshop, what's actually going on with the trainers? What are they teaching these human rights activists?
Yeah, so the two trainers, Ali, who's a friend of mine and a colleague, I've known him for years now. He's actually taught me, he's trained me. So I can talk very in detail about the kinds of trainings he does because he's just a fantastic trainer. It's basically how do we operate in the online world? How do we understand what information is, how it flows from one part of the internet to another? He's got a fantastic game that he calls Romeo and Juliet, where he lines everybody up in a circle of 15, 20 people, and you literally act out the internet. So over here I'd be a router, and then the person next to me might be an ISP, and we'd go all the way around, and you try and send a piece of communication from Romeo all the way around the internet to Juliet. And then you obviously add in layers of encryption and you make that communication more secure. You throw in a few rogue hackers along the way to try and disrupt it, maybe an NSA operative, in order to understand that, when we talk about security online, it really depends on so many things. It depends on where the threat's coming from. It depends on what you're trying to do. But it's really simple stuff, because most activists don't actually know anything about digital security. Like most people, we're still in the very first phases of understanding how the internet changes everything and how vulnerable we are, whether it's from cyber hackers and criminals or our own governments.
Because digital security is when your password is password, but you change the A to a 1.
That's exactly it. That's pretty much level one of Ali's training. No, but really, seriously, there's a whole session on how to create a strong password. And it really, the first bit is how many people in this room have the password as their password? And there's usually a couple. Wow. Because, you know, that's the level often of a lot of activists, unfortunately. Of course, we've had to get a lot better quickly because the world's changing fast. And so this training was about getting them up to speed and how to actually secure themselves online.
And the reason I think it's really important to talk about Turkey is because something quite new is going on here, especially around the way that the government is targeting IT contractors, for example, and targeting encryption. But maybe it'd be helpful just to kind of step back and set the scene a little bit. So last year there was an attempted coup in Turkey. A bunch of commandos kind of, tried to capture the President Erdogan, and they were flying helicopters all around where he was supposed to be. But he wasn't there because he'd been tipped off, and he was instead on his way, I think, to Istanbul. And while he was going there, he sent out a message saying, "There's a coup going on. Come try and save me." And people stormed onto the streets. 250 people were killed. And ever since then, we've seen that there's been this really big crackdown against dissent in any form against the government. This has kind of been the case in Turkey for a while. But what's really changed since the attempted coup?
The last year has been really a spiral for human rights in Turkey. It's the purge that has happened on the back of that attempted coup of anyone who is remotely critical of Erdogan and his policies and his government is astounding. And Amnesty's documented this. Really, you know, it's purges in the civil service, in the government, across all industries. The most recent, which is only in the last month, if you've started seeing, there was an arrest warrant put out for 100 IT contractors. But we've seen it across all sectors and industries in the last year. Thousands of people have lost their jobs. Hundreds and thousands of arrest warrants have gone out. You know, each month there's a new roundup, basically. Tons and tons of people have been detained. Anyone who's a critical voice, anyone who's well known, anyone who stands up for human rights, democracy, free speech, has become on the bullseye, in a sense, of Erdogan. It's still surprising. I think it's still taken us by surprise just how far it's gone, because, you know, when you've got the director of Amnesty International, it's actually the first time in our organisation's history that that's ever happened, that you've got a director of Amnesty, you know, couldn't be more of a safe character, in a sense. You know, we're talking about someone here with years and years of professional experience, of being a prominent voice inside Turkey, being also arrested and accused of aiding and abetting a terrorist organisation. I mean, it's just so far-fetched. I think that's what's hard to get your head around. It's so far-fetched that they see Ali and Peter, these two, you know, international trainers, as threatening or in any way linked to terrorism. And so I think it's this link between dissent in any form and the Gulenists, you know, the terrorists inside Turkey has become, they basically mean the same thing to Erdogan. And so you've just got a total crackdown.
And why do you think there's been a step change in terms of going after IT workers now specifically? I mean, obviously, like you say, they're teaching people how to use these really important tools to stay safe online. But do you think it's as much as anything coming from countries outside of Turkey as well, and the fact that the debate now is so big on encryption and how it can be used by terrorists and you know, governments of all flavours trying to supposedly crack down on it?
So inside Turkey, there's a very clear link in the mind of the government, which is that supposedly there's this app out there called Bylock, which is an encrypted app. I've never heard of Bylock before until it reached the news via Turkey. It was an app that was on the Google Play Store until 2014. It then was taken down. It seems to have been distributed online. We've had some of our sort of security specialists take a look at it a little bit. No one really knows where this app was coming from or how it was being distributed. But it seemed to have been picked up in Turkey as an app for opposition, as an app for journalists. You know, as these things happen, you hear word of mouth and someone tells you, oh, this is the secure app to use, and then people start using it. So it did, for whatever reason, get picked up in Turkey. And the Turkish authorities have linked anyone who is using Bylock or who's downloaded it in the past, they've put arrest warrants out for them. So in fact, the 100 IT contractors were all supposedly users of Bylock. Mm-hmm. They've 2 months before they arrested our director in Turkey, they also arrested someone on our board of directors in Turkey, the board of Amnesty Turkey. And the charges facing him are that he had downloaded Bylock. Mm-hmm. He actually tells us, you know, he'd never even heard of Bylock until he saw it in the news. So of course, whether or not people were actually using the app is really kind of irrelevant, because they seem to be able to use it as a excuse to round up anyone. But it's also just, of course, ludicrous that just downloading or use of an encrypted app could be seen as a crime. And so that's part of how we got to this point in Turkey, is that you know, anything to do with use of security encryption has become synonymous with, you know, potential terrorism. Mm-hmm. But it is a scary trend outside of Turkey as well. And I you know, we've seen it here in the UK with the statements that have been made by Amber Rudd and Theresa May over time. It sort of seems to be the go-to thing now. If we have a terrorist attack, one of them will come out within 2 days afterwards and talk about the fact that this was aided by secure spaces online, such as WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. And so there is this link kind of emerging, and I think it's part of a global trend where people are saying, well, why should you, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, if you're really doing nothing wrong, why should you be protecting your communications? Why would you want to be encrypting your communications? And of course, that falls totally apart. It falls apart anyway, just to begin with. There's lots of reasons why you can critique it. But when you're talking about human rights activists, when you're talking about us at Amnesty International, I mean, I have so many reasons that I need to encrypt my communications, you know, whether it's working on sensitive cases or with individuals who are likely to be massively targeted for that communication with Amnesty. We have to take those precautions. Yeah. It's not a case of, you know, a convenience or something that we do because it's a nice add-on. It's actually just integral to communications in this modern world when there's so many threats around.
Yeah, and it's essential to consumers now as well. And it has been for years, but I think that there's a growing awareness that, you know, banking and all sorts of things that we use every day need to have this tech wrapped around it. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Amber Rudd, because she this week spoke about real people not really caring about encryption, and that companies often will offer trade-offs in order that people can use apps in a convenient way, like you say. But yeah, there is this chilling effect, isn't there? And then at the moment, you know, we supposedly here in the UK are in a mature democracy. But then if you look at Turkey's model and where things might fall down, that becomes a really important issue.
I mean, I just think it's so strange to keep hearing politicians talk about the fact that they need to backdoor or weaken encryption, because it just doesn't make sense, even from their own perspectives. You've seen Hillary Clinton, you've seen, you know, top politicians move over to using WhatsApp or Signal, which is another encrypted app, because they themselves have become, you know, they've seen the consequences of repeated leaks and data breaches. Mm-hmm. You know, no major company has survived the last 10 years without a major data breach. You know, this is part of the modern world. And I think we recently saw the NHS, all of its systems go down in a number of locations because of a zero-day vulnerability, an exploit that had been created by the NSA that had then got leaked online, been used by a hacker or a set of hackers who then were using it as ransomware, so they were trying to just make some money out of it. But our entire critical infrastructure, healthcare infrastructure, went down. I mean, you couldn't get more clear evidence of the fact that we do need really serious security, and that governments need it as much as the citizens need it. We all need it, and it's just not plausible. It's not possible to think about how you would weaken that.
Because Turkey, what's happening in Turkey is kind of the leading edge of this trend right now, isn't it? But I wonder, I mean, what were the steps along the way to get to this point? Because you must have been seeing little signs around the world that this was an emerging trend. I mean, I wonder, because there was in Ethiopia some bloggers were kind of arrested for a similar reason.
Yeah, some bloggers were arrested, part of a collective of bloggers called Zone 9, and detained again for attending. I think at the time it was for attending a digital security workshop, but also for their use of digital security, encrypted tools. Mm-hmm. This year, or at the very end of last year, seven Moroccan journalists were charged because they had been using an app called Storymaker, which was basically an app that was designed to help you publish online as a journalist, but it had a security feature, which was anonymity. So it helps you publish anonymously, because obviously mm-hmm. being able to publish not in your name in countries like Morocco can be really important for freedom of expression. And then they were charged with, again, this link of, oh, you're using something that gives you an anonymity that therefore makes you suspect, that therefore means you're plotting something. So we have seen it happen along the way. But I think what's going on in Turkey is just, it's unprecedented. It's the first, it's a full assault on encryption. It's a full assault on the use of digital security in it as any protective measure. I think once you've, again, made encryption synonymous with terrorist activity, mm-hmm. we're all in such a bad place. And I think that's why, if you're here in the UK, you should be thinking about what's going on in Turkey. We've seen a turnaround in a country that... I was there 2 years ago for the Internet Governance Forum, and it was where the UN decided to host their global, you know, annual summit on the internet. That was just 2 years ago in Istanbul. And now 2 years later, we've got to a point where any use of digital security or a digital security training is a cause to round people up. It's just a reminder that things change quickly and governments are capricious. what's seen as a legitimate activity one day is something you should be, you know, seen as something that you're hiding the next, or mm-hmm. something suspect. And so, yeah, we have to really be vigilant.
Yeah, I was at a human rights conference recently, and the thing that I really observed when I was there was that there was this in the crowd between people who were mainly scared of governments and people who were mainly scared of companies. Which one are you more mm-hmm. scared of? Or is that a bit of a false distinction?
It's an interesting question. I remember at the time when we were really trying to campaign against mass surveillance, and we were really trying to raise awareness of the fact that you might not feel personally affected right now by the fact that all the government is bulk collecting all of your data, but there is something you've given up, and you might not see it yet, but by the time you can see it, it will be really, really dangerous. Mm-hmm. And sort of trying to link that to lots of other things. And I remember that we looked at a poll that said that most people's part of their kind of shrugged their shoulders was, why would I care if my government's doing it? Because I already know that Facebook and Google and all the others do it anyway. And it's almost there's no point caring because it's so far out of our control, and that's actually something being led mainly by companies, not by governments. I think that there is a false distinction there. And I think, you know, something we were looking at not long ago was... there's a whole murky industry of data brokers. And these are companies you've probably not even heard their names. They're not the Googles and Facebooks. They're Axioms and Experians. But they buy and sell personal data. And it's insane once you start to look kind of under the bonnet how much data they have. Mm-hmm. And they're collecting it, and it can be used for all sorts of purposes. And it can also be sold back to law enforcement and sold back to security agencies. In the context of the US, you will see... that at a state level, police forces might be able to access data on you that they've bought from a private broker, much, you know, that they wouldn't be able to collect under the Constitution. It would have been, you know, completely illegal constitutionally, mm-hmm. but they can just go down the road and purchase it because it's all there now. It's all there, and there's a huge private sector of it. So I think that the idea that they're totally apart is false. Once Google's got it on their servers, We know that the NSA in the past has had full-blown access to Google servers. What's to assume that they couldn't do the same again? There's cooperation often between companies and governments. And we're not just talking about USA and UK here. We are talking about Turkey and Russia and China and countries where people have a lot more to lose. I think it's interesting this Sunday, Putin in Russia has also blocked VPNs. He's passed a law to criminalise use of VPNs.
Because it is possible to tell if someone's using a VPN, for example, and that way you can make the use of that technology. It's the same thing, isn't it? Make the use of that technology the reason why you target people. So it becomes, in a strange way, unsafe to be safe online.
Yeah, exactly. And we all become so... It's like a race to the bottom. We all just become more vulnerable online. I don't understand how anyone gains from from us all having less strong security practice.
I mean, we also had Sheryl Sandberg just last week talking on Radio 4. She was on Desert Island Discs, of all things. And one of her justifications for, you know, kind of keeping encryption on WhatsApp was that they do cooperate with the government and, you know, that metadata is available and that's a key point. And, you know, if they don't offer up that option or that if people think it's a less secure app, then they'll go elsewhere. And you know, there are other companies that won't cooperate with the government. So so that was quite interesting.
Cheryl 2020. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Well, the companies are walking a fine line, aren't they? Because on the one hand, they recognise that consumer privacy is important to consumers and therefore has to be important to them, because otherwise they'll lose out their share of the market. And on the other hand, they don't want to be regulated at all. And so they constantly, you know, it's how much they give and take in their relationships with governments, because they also just want to be kind of left alone. And so it's just, we work with companies a lot, and in terms of understanding what they, how they play a role in all of this. And sometimes they can really be strong advocates and allies in terms of defending privacy. I think since Snowden, you've seen major companies take huge steps forward. I think the fact that we've got end-to-end encryption in WhatsApp is an enormous step forward for privacy.
Yeah,
a massive victory and the result of a lot of hard work by a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm. Although there was some problems in Turkey about WhatsApp, weren't there? But there was a Guardian article saying that there was a backdoor into WhatsApp. And then some security researchers said that as a result, a lot of people in Turkey had left WhatsApp thinking that this backdoor was more serious than it was and that they'd been caught out as a result.
Yeah, so actually I think that was a bit of a false flag.
The backdoor into WhatsApp, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah.
People just didn't understand. And this is what we all come down to, is understanding what is secure and not secure. It's such a complicated terrain, and you always have to, at the end of the day, come down to some expert that can tell you if it is or if it isn't, and trust. And I think it's, you know, look at Turkey. They may have felt so afraid of using WhatsApp for false reason. Actually, they had no reason to fear WhatsApp was backdoored at that point. It was just a sort of technicality in how the features work. And they'd all rushed off to Bylock, which was an app that no one knew how it was being distributed, knock through the Google Play Store, and look what's happened as a result of that. So I just think it shows what a difficult terrain it is for most ordinary people to navigate. Just, I don't know, someone can you just tell me, what can I trust? It seems to change from day to day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we've got trade deals obviously going on between governments as well. So on Tuesday, the Department for International Trade released details of export licenses handled between January 1st and March 31st this year. Included in those licences is one to Turkey relating to software for telecommunications interception equipment for a law enforcement agency.
So basically the UK government is selling surveillance to Turkey.
And that's not a new thing either.
Yeah.
And the UK government will be selling the same kind of surveillance equipment to many, many countries where we would have serious concerns about how that was then used and whether that company could be complicit in human rights violations committed by the government. Of course, it's particularly shocking in the context of how much we've known about Turkey in the last 6 months. You know, if they were selling that in first quarter of this year between January and March, it was already widely known that Turkey had began its huge purge of you know, dissent and anyone who spoke up and was critical of the government. So the UK government has, you know, sold this equipment, interception equipment, in the context of knowing that human rights violations are occurring inside Turkey. And that should technically not be allowed to happen under EU licensing laws. But at the moment, it just shows, I think, we're in a little bit of a Wild West still, where the kind of technology that's dual use, where it has a legitimate purpose, but also can be used in these really harmful ways to crack down on activists and journalists and others, it's quite easy to sell it. It's quite easy to be a company that sets up tomorrow. We've seen some really small rogue companies that exist, like Hacking Team and Finfisher, who are just selling all over the world. And they're actually just a band of, maybe 20 technologists or hackers who've created a product and are then able to sell it to Ethiopia, to Morocco, to Turkey. And no one's really keeping an eye on how that's used. And at the moment, the regulation just isn't strong enough to, you know, it should be a little bit more akin to traditional arms. although not that when we get onto traditional arms, we're on much better ground when it comes to who the UK is selling what to who.
I mean, how could the government crack down on that in terms of regulation, or governments, I should say, really?
So there is an opportunity at the moment at the EU level for there to be a stronger emphasis on doing human rights impact assessments within export licensing. That Amnesty have been working on quite a bit, actually. And, you know, there is hope that, I think certain governments recognise that this is the moment there's a grey area there. There's a kind of a bit of a Wild West and it needs tightening up. And that part of that is just holding the licensing authorities in each country to a higher standard in terms of actually doing these impact assessments. How will this equipment be used once it's in Erdogan's hands? How will it be used? How can we ensure that this will only be used in accordance with international human rights law in a very narrow set of circumstances that are legitimate, that are necessary? Mm-hmm. At the moment, of course, it just gets sold and who knows what it's used for. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine in the current context in Turkey, it's very easy to imagine that UK sold equipment is directly linked to some of the human rights abuses that are happening.
Sure.
So yeah, it's very worrying that it's, the UK government hasn't taken a more robust and strong stance on that.
Yeah, and I guess with Brexit, you know, the UK might not be involved in those discussions at an EU level, and who knows, you know, what their thinking is on this. There could be a market there.
Yeah.
You know, that they can exploit somehow, which is also very worrying, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's no knowing. I guess one, we've got to actually get the law to change first at the European level, which is hard enough, and then two, how will that actually filter down and affect practice in a country like the UK, given there's so much uncertainty around Brexit? It's
because I mean they are having to look at different trade deals, so quality control, who knows.
I mean, because one theory about Turkey is that it's part of a more widespread democratic recession, and you can lump Trump into that. Maybe what's going on in Hungary. I mean, does it feel that way to you, or is Turkey actually an outlier here?
I think what's going on in Turkey is really genuinely shocking. I think it's the kind of purge, you know, you see historical purges, I think, in different countries where in history, you know, they've started with civil service and started with massive job losses and then mass arrests. What's happening in Turkey, I think we shouldn't sort of just pin it as part of a global trend. I think it warrants proper scrutiny and understanding that it's exceptional, actually, and it should be treated as exceptional, and it should be inviting very strong positions from European governments in terms of opposing Erdogan and what he's doing. At the same time, it is true that there is a global trend towards more, there has been in the last couple of years a number of governments that have popped up and that I think exhibit some of similar concerns from a perspective of civil society, from the perspective of free speech, from the perspective of people being able to hold opinions and express them freely. And I think what's even more notable is this thing about digital security and encryption. I think that you can say is part of a global trend. I think the linking of suspicious behaviour to use of encryption is something that's been rearing its head here and there. Each time that there's a terrorist attack, each time that there's, you know, it's national security, and whether it's Erdogan saying it's national security for him because he's, you know, his power is threatened by, you know, Gulenists and coup plotters, or if it's Theresa May or Trump or anybody else saying, well, this is we have to fight back because terrorism is existing and having spaces to grow in online, because of encryption in online safe spaces, as they keep on saying. That's part of a trend that I think is really global. And you've got one end, the sharp end is Turkey, and then you've got the much more kind of acceptable end, which is Theresa May. But I do think we should be very, very cautious about that. And I would love it if more people would understand that, you know, this is not just a convenience or something, a luxury that we've got in terms of having privacy and security online, but it's actually something we need to defend, because if we're not defending it, we're really losing so much. And it, like I said before, we won't notice yet that we've lost it until it's too late. look to Turkey, look what can happen when your government decides tomorrow that, you know, it's a much larger pool of people that it counts as suspicious. You know, things do change. History should teach us that. We should be really defending with a lot of vigour the fact that we have the right to communicate securely online.
Because I guess in you're saying you've been at Amnesty 5 years, is that right? Because I think 2012, was that the kind of peak of belief about the Twitter revolutions, social media really changing things in Iran, in Egypt? I mean, what's happened?
Yeah, what a good question. Yeah, when I was in 2009, I was in Honduras after a military coup, and I remember that feeling that this was, I remember the language around it and everything, you know, this was removing traditional gatekeepers like the media, like even like organisations like Amnesty. This was direct democracy. This was a way for people to publish instantly to millions. You know, there would never be a spot in the world where you couldn't shine a light on a human rights abuse because it could be communicated instantly everywhere. And that, in a sense, that was true and it remains true. But I think we've just seen such a regression from that point. I think maybe there was a little moment where, thanks to social media and governments not knowing how to control it yet, there was a slight free space. So that was the Wild West, in a sense, the Wild West of people being able to express themselves freely. And then governments have clawed back a lot of control very quickly. And I think the first wake up of that was, you know, with Snowden. It was like, oh, they're not even really clawing it back. The NSA's had total visibility and control of it all along. But then since then, I think we've just seen it in one country after another, that, you know, whether it's turning off the internet, as happened in Ethiopia at the end of last year, or it's just blocking the services that are end-to-end encrypted, so as Brazil has done with WhatsApp, as, you know, Signal was blocked in Egypt. It's just one after another, and you just get the distinct impression that governments now actually have access to a far wider range of technologies than they've ever had ever in history. So if anyone's benefiting from the technological revolution, it's not necessarily citizens and individuals. It's also governments who can afford really sophisticated inception technologies or fantastic spyware off the shelf, really simple to buy and get, you know, install. And you know, just this morning we saw another piece of news that Mexico, a couple of lawyers who are working on major human rights cases, people who've been disappeared, have also been infected by this NSO spyware, which is an Israeli company selling spyware to what looks like most plausibly the Mexican government, although it's very difficult to prove. And that's another way that we're on the back foot. It's not only do they have access to all of these, you know, much more sophisticated technologies, the technologies are very, very secretive and difficult to see, and very often we don't know that they're there. So even proving it is quite difficult. And I think I'm certainly at a point where I'm like, some of the optimism around that first heady wave of, look what the internet can offer, I think I'm definitely now, we need to be really holding on and firmly to what we've got and really defending our rights online, because it may not look like this in 5 years' time if we're not really vigilant.
I mean, one of the odd things actually is that from government's point of view, just speaking to people in that world, is that they feel more vulnerable than ever as well, because they feel like you know, any bunch of random hackers can initiate an attack that they don't understand that will bring down crucial systems, and they feel like if there was a really large scale attack, because so many of our systems are now networked, you know, day one there'd be no sat nav, there'd be no communications, there'd be no nothing. Day two be the national grid. I think there is this kind of ramping up on, or sort of this sense of fear and vulnerability on both sides in a way. But I guess in a way that kind of brings me to probably the final question, might possibly impossible to answer, but how do we get ourselves out of this trouble that we've got into? Is there a way?
Well, for starters, let's not weaken and backdoor the one type of security that we know does work online and that does protect both the governments and the activists and everybody else, which is encryption. I think there's no way to picture a future online that is safe and that allows the NHS to run critical health infrastructure and allows banks to do incredibly complex financial transactions all across the world and allows digital security trainers and activists to, you know, go out and teach how basic password security. All of those people rely on encryption, all of them. And I think we should be defending encryption, and I think we've got to fight back against this insidious language that's emerging each time. It's very alarmist. It's part of the sort of terrorism theatre in general, isn't it? Just of, oh, you know, the hacker, the baddies, the bad people out there, whether they're the Turkish coup plotters or they're the terrorists, they can use these tools in ways that we can't see, and that's really dangerous. I think we will always live with risk in the world. We've always lived with risk, and we have to rely on the tools that are available to fight back against those, you know, those threats where they're real, where they do exist. But it's not proportionate to just weaken the entire internet as a result, and everybody's left so much more vulnerable if we do that. So I think it's a plea to governments to have some common sense, really, and not shoot themselves in their own foot while they're trying to fight legitimate threats, and actually to be more reasonable about it and realise that they've got a really big armoury of tools available to them now, like they've never had before, and that they can fight the threats that they see online without, you know, without this kind of hugely disproportionate, let's block WhatsApp, let's dismantle security online. That's just not going to be good for anyone.
Amber Rudd, if you're listening, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Please.
Well, and just on that point, her website is very secure. It's over HTTPS, and I'm sure she uses WhatsApp and all those other lovely E2E apps that are out there. So, you know, hypocrite, yeah. Maybe? Who knows?
Yes.
Well, one more thing I just wanted to say is, like, I always think I didn't used to encrypt everything. I might have even at some point been in the camp of, oh, you know, mm-hmm. I don't have anything to hide. Why would I worry? Until I started working on all of this and realised how silly that is as a position. But I think that it's a little bit like seatbelts. We haven't, you know, we haven't evolved yet to understand risk online. Mm-hmm. We don't see it coming. You see a bus coming and you know, I don't want to step out in the road in front of that giant hunk of moving metal because it's going to hurt me somehow. But when we get in a car and we put a seatbelt on, we don't feel that risk as much. It's a much more abstract risk. We only feel it really because the law tells us we should wear a seatbelt and people tell us statistically we've got a better chance of living. And I think it's almost like, I don't know about you guys, but I actually feel funny if I don't put a seatbelt on these days. You know, that the risk is still very abstract, but over time it's changed my mind a little bit. And I don't think, I just am like, oh, something's wrong. Oh, yeah, need to put my seatbelt on. And I think encryption's like that. Over time, we will feel vulnerable when we're not encrypting. And I already feel that. If I'm sending a certain message or communicating with colleagues about certain issues, I just feel something's wrong here if I'm not using an end-to-end encrypted channel. And I think we can evolve in that direction, and more people will.
Okay. Almost a hopeful point to end on. Tanya, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another Upvote. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
Goodbye.